Hello, and welcome to the Doing Social Research podcast, where I talk with some of my favorite people who do social research to dig into the cool projects they're working on. My goal is to help demystify research for students, inspire other researchers, and provide a platform for all the brilliant work of folks doing research in the humanities and social sciences. I'm your host, Phyllis Rippey, a professor of sociology at the University of Ottawa and creator of the website doingsocialresearch.com. But today, we're not here to talk about me. We're here to talk about one of my oldest friends, Dr. Maggie M. Werner. Dr. Werner is professor of writing and rhetoric at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, specializing in rhetorical criticism and sexual rhetorics. She earned a BA in English and an MA in professional writing and rhetorics from Illinois State University, and a PhD in rhetoric and composition in the teaching of English from the University of Arizona in 2011. Her research has been published in Western Journal of Communication, Feminist Formations, Rhetoric Review, Composition Studies, Present Tense, and the collection Peace and Social Justice Education on Campus. Longtime fans, of me, that is, might also remember Maggie from the very final episode of the Rippey Sisters podcast, but I promise she didn't, wasn't the cause of the end. And on that episode, we talked about her 2020 monograph, Stripped, Reading the Erotic Body, published by Penn State University Press. This amazing book was listed as one of the best new rhetoric books to read in 2021 by the Book Authority website. Based on 15 years of ethnographic study of strip clubs and burlesque shows, i.e., she went to a lot of strip clubs and burlesque shows, among many other things, she expertly blended classical and contemporary rhetorical and performance studies with intersectional feminist analyses and personal narratives to explore how we can read the sexualized body. Part of what I found brilliant about her work is how she gives agency to the subjects of her topic, while at the same time grappling with her own desires and potentially objectifying gaze. Rather than purely extracting information from the performers or dissecting their performances, as a rhetorician, her aim was to read the messages that they themselves were trying to convey. What emerged was a beautiful and powerful understanding of how erotic dancers create and convey meaning through their bodies, thereby situating the dancers themselves at the center of control. And this approach was a real radical departure from a lot of theorizing and writing that portrays sex workers as victims at the hands of primarily male bouncers, pimps, and consumers. And it also forced the reader to consider our own assumptions of what sexualized bodies are trying to tell us. However, she has more recently changed tacks away from human subjects research and is currently working on a co-author book about portmanteau words, which I'm going to let her explain because I keep having to Google this every time I look at like writing the bio notes and I'm like, what is a portmanteau word? And then I look it up and then I'm like, oh my God, this is so intriguing. So I'm very excited to hear like what the heck that is. Also, Maggie teaches writing and rhetorical criticism, focusing particularly on analysis, argumentation, and style. And I really would love to dig into that a little bit, maybe offering some advice on writing effectively for our listeners. And we got so much to talk about. It's already like 17 minutes in, and that did not take me 17 minutes because we can't stop talking. So I'm so excited. Welcome to my new podcast, Maggie.
Thank you, Phyllis. That was so nice. I was sitting here getting, as you can imagine, really uncomfortable because you were saying nice things and I wanted to be like, no.
Oh my God. It's so funny dumb. To get, well, because like I ask people like, can you, you know, if you can send me a bio, that would be helpful. And the differences between different people, like some people will send me like, I mean, everyone is a little bit sheepish, but it's like some people will send me, you know, to their website and it happens to have a lot longer. Yours was like three sentences and you're like, well, you can cut whatever you want. I was like, cut what? Your name? Anyway, I was like, that is not singing your praises nearly enough. So, and it's all true. And I loved your book. Per my brand, Doing Social Research, can you tell me about what's the research that you're doing these days and what the F are portmanteau words and why are you writing a book about them or whatever? What are you researching?
Okay. Well, portmanteau words are, that's just the pretentious name for a blended word or lexical blends, as they're called. Ooh, in linguistics. Portmanteau, which is also a portmanteau, comes from the French words porter, and which means to carry, and coat, or manteau, which means coat. So a portmanteau is like a kind
of... Or to wear.
Oh, to wear.
ports.
Shit, I thought it was Carrie.
It is. Like,
and it can be. Okay, so it's Carrie is the definition we want to go with. So, okay. So it's portmanteau is like a 19th century trunk people used to carry. So it's like a traveling trunk. Trunks. Anyway, it comes from Alice in Wonderland. It's like a cloak carrier, and it was the name of these trunks. So a portmanteau is a large hinged trunk with like two sides. So if you Google it, you'll find that. So in this is the longest explanation that you don't need, but longest.
This is this podcast, this brand is long explanations.
Well, anybody who writes about portmanteaus has to start. It's almost a commonplace that you start with what it means and that it's made of these French words. It's a blend, and that where it comes from is Jabberwocky when Humpty Dumpty is explaining the meaning of words like slithy and lithe. And he says to Alice, well, it's like a portmanteau. There are two meanings packed up into one word. So that's where, so we use the metaphorical portmanteau, partially because we're rhetoricians and we like that and we like the word. And it's sort of more in line with our research because we're not linguists and we're not talking about things like patterns of combining and all of these other things that linguists write about. We're writing about meaning and how meaning gets generated and how they become sort of complex carriers of meaning and sometimes can be used to sort of problematically slide in things into words that seem innocuous, which is the basis of our first publication about, which is not in my bio. I was like, oh, damn, I have something else.
I drew from your website. I also noticed that the Rippy Sisters podcast is not in
I'm sorry, I haven't updated it in years. I'm so sorry.
No, oh my God, don't.
No, I love that show. I've listened to it more than once. So, anyway, so we did an article on the portmanteau Megxit, all right, which is from Meghan Markle exiting the royal family. So the first article was about how that word, which seems, again, innocuous, I'm probably going to keep saying that, actually became this sort of function kind of like an ideograph, which is like a one word that carries these entire ideological systems. So we found that people would use Megxit was already attaching it with like really racist politics and sort of pro-monarchy, anti-Meghan, or pro-U.S., like patriotism.
How was that like, because I'm just thinking like Brexit and that it's so explain more, like go through all of it.
Okay, so I mean the argument is that we provide a methodology kind of for breaking down these portmanteau words. So you sort of have to examine each input stem is what they're called. So Meghan and exit. All right. So exit isn't just exit. Exit gets its ideological baggage from Brexit. Brexit is also tied to sort of nationalistic, racist discourses, pro-monarchy, pro-country. And the people who were using the term in the United States were generally also racist and patriotic. Pro-Trump MAGAs. So we were saying, well, this is interesting that the people who hate Meghan and use this hashtag also have these others. So we sort of were talking about the baggage that comes from Brexit, right? It no longer means exit anymore. Now it means something else. And so then we sort of just, you know, gave a longer, more coherent argument about how this
works. Was very coherent. That was very coherent. I don't know why this. Have you ever read any of Sarah Ahmed's stuff?
Yeah.
About like exit.
No.
That's totally fine, but it's just really interesting because when you're talking about this, it makes me think. And I hate it when people cite people and I don't know it, and then I'm like, I'm a failure. I should have known that. So don't feel that way. She's written like a million books, and a million ideas. And the only reason why I think I think I assigned it maybe in a class or something. And anyway, but she talks about exit as a form of like political protest that could be really interesting. But she talks about it because she's talking about why she left academia, basically. And so I'm very interested because I often am like, do I want to be here? Do I want all of these things? Like, do I like, there's things that are very challenging. And, you know, there's also like, she talks about it in terms of the sort of like, you know, white supremacy that's like inherent in academia and in the UK where she lives and works. But it all like it, there's something like how you're talking about this. It makes me like slightly sad in a certain way, because it's like she's trying like, but it is, I mean, I think it's a very similar thing though, in terms of this idea of exit as a form of resistance, like exit as a form of saying, I don't approve of this. I don't like this anymore. And so like in a certain sense, like what you're describing is, you know, Meghan Markle trying to claim, like attain some kind of agency, which also reminds me of your book and the sort of brilliant way that you have at trying to explore the ways in which sort of those who are often vilified in the media, how they try to claim this kind of agency, but then also that is constantly tangled up in these kinds of conservative controlling discourses and rhetorics of like trying to make the resistance or the control problematic. Does that all make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's like, that's so fascinating. So in your book, so your article, where did it come out so people can read it? I need to take a note of it.
Western Journal of Communication.
Okay.
I said with a question mark. Yes. No, that it absolutely was the Western Journal of Communication. And I'm listed as the second author. We're co-authors, though. We're in the humanities and we don't do that kind of bullshit.
There's no ranking of who was.
There's no ranking about who does more. So
interesting.
Anyway.
Oh, that sucks that your last name starts with a W. Do you do it alphabetically?
Well, she's Star Van Gurry. So we're very, very close. I just wanted to say to look up the article, it's like the first author is Star Van Gurry, V-A-N-G-U-R-I. And Star is my bestie from grad school and now my bestie for life. And
I love working with besties.
Oh my gosh. It's just so great. I don't know if I used to would be like, I'm never going to collaborate. Now I'm kind of like, I don't know if I ever want to write by myself again, but, yeah, we're working on the book together.
I wanted to talk about that. Actually, let's just digress for 1 second I would love to talk about process, like talking about working with others. I know that when we were emailing back and forth, you were like, well, I can't on these days because I have this standing meeting with my co-author. And I was like, that is so cool. Because I often, when I'm collaborating with someone, it's like, I'll do a version and then I'll send it back to them and then I'll come back. And so generally speaking, it is every week I say to my co-author, sorry, I have nothing to report.
We're talking to you. That's like our meeting.
I have nothing to report. So I'm just like, I'm really curious about like, what are your strategies? How, what are you doing? What are you and are you co-authoring the book with Star also?
Yes.
Okay,
and she'll be first author on that too. So no.
Okay. Star?
Yeah. So my collaborator is Dr. Star Van Gurry, and she's a professor of media and communications at Nova Southeastern University, in Florida. Yeah, so I just wanted to give her a shout out because she's brilliant and is the reason why I'm on this track. So I'm sorry, what was the question? It was how do we work those meetings?
Yeah. What are your meetings like? Are they totally linear and never have tangents and you never change the subject like you and I are doing?
Exactly. No, yeah, after like 20 minutes of being like, why isn't it our job to name products? Or, you know, sorry. Yeah, we meet and I've been on sabbatical this semester. So I, you know, took on more of the writing and, you know, Star's teaching four and is like the, you know, chair of the grad program. And
oh, my God.
It has two small children. Well, not small. They're under 10, though. So
that's small. That's
yeah.
Small.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I mean, they're not little. They're like big.
No. But that's demanding. They can't drive themselves. They
exactly.
Like, are so still like you don't have to wipe butts, but they do like, you don't want to know what they do.
We have total activities, you know. It's yes. like, anyway, so we'll go on and Star will be like, I've done nothing. And I'm like, okay. And then she's like, I was like, no, that's what we agreed on. So what we usually do is we like talk a little bit about what we're doing, and we talk through problems and we set agendas. And I think the most fun thing that probably not a lot of people do is we actually write together when we
That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah. Yeah. So when we get to the stage where we usually like we'll write stuff separately and then come together. And then our general, our best process is for me to read, because I can't, as you might have this problem, I can't listen.
Right.
So yeah. I really find listening a challenge. So Star listens, I read, and she's like able to, and then we'll stop and be like, okay. And she's really good at being like, this makes no sense. Or we've said this three times, and yeah. then we play with wording and we just correct it. And then we go on. And I love those days, because it's really like, I was telling one of my students this the other day, it's like, who's going to grad school, you have to get to the place where you realize that revision is your writing, you know?
Yes.
That's where the work is done. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. I bought, and I just started to read it. Sometimes I listen better than I read, but I don't always take in all the information, but I often listen. This is a sort of another thing. We're all over the place because both of us have ADHD, which is another topic to talk about. But sometimes I will listen while reading because it helps focus my brain a little bit more, which I think is a really good like technique. And so I think like reading aloud is another thing that helps. But so there's this book by Howard Becker that it's like, I keep citing things that I've read, like the first chapter and then put down, and then it's not in front of my face. So obviously it ceases to exist, but he talks about, and I'm thinking about assigning it for like all of my classes into the future, that he says like students need to understand that writing is editing, and that in undergrad, it's so often that you have like five papers due at the same time. And so you end up like writing them the night before, and like whatever comes, like you write it, it like shoots out of your printer and you hand it in. Mm-hmm. And so students in grad school, they really struggle because they don't understand that it's like that needs to happen like weeks, months, mm-hmm. years, sometimes before mm-hmm. whatever the final outcome is, and that the work is editing and editing and editing. It's never like nobody writes, like we write shit on the first draft, you know. I mean, I'm sure not you, but many of us, it's you know, but just as you said, writing is editing. Okay, I'm talking too much. I want this to be about you. So that's amazing. So the two of you can write together, and but you sort of have your own drafts that you've developed on your own, kind of.
And then because we, you know, polish together, I think we did a good job of having a coherent voice. So it doesn't really sound like me in the same way that my book sounds like me.
Interesting.
And it doesn't really sound like her in the stuff she doesn't do with me, right? So it's kind of like our argument about the portmanteau. It's like, it's not really our argument. It's just kind of the way it is that it's like a new third thing. It's like the blend is not just a sum of the two parts. The blend becomes a third thing, a new third thing. And that's kind of how our writing is. So if you read our article, it does not sound. But there will be always be something, because I'm always the one who wants to put like something pretentious in there. And I'll be like, oh, that's such a Maggie word, or like put in things like fait accompli and shit like that, you know, like, and I'll be like, so anytime it's like super pretentious, I'll be like, that's the Maggie line.
It's okay. I was talking with my, the last episode that was released was my friend, Mike Allen. His supervisor, I'm like so bad about name drop, but I can't help it. One of his supervisors in grad school was Judith Butler. Oh. And I know. So we were talking, and he writes like, I don't like calling it pretentious, but I would say like, and you also are very good at this, at writing in a way that I am terrible at, which is like that very like esoteric academic stuff. Like, and like there's a part of one of her books that I should probably look up to see where it is, but she talks about, she sort of engages in that idea of like why, like people criticize her for writing like that, but she's like, fuck off. I like it. Like, I like writing like this. It's interesting. It works my brain. There's like a challenge. And it was after that, because I used to be one of the critics of it. I'm like, just make it simple, make it clear for everyone. And then I was like, well, no, there is something kind of engaging and interesting about really like finding just the right words. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't see you as a pretentious person at all, like as a human being. So the fact that you describe the writing as pretentious, I feel like maybe it's not that it's pretentious, but it is precise. I don't know.
Possibly. I've also criticized Judith Butler's prose, but it's hard for me. I don't, you know, I'm not like Judith Butler's stupid, but I realize that her style is her style, you know, and it works for her. And like you said, when I can, although it's very difficult for me because of the way I read or don't read, so I sort of don't read words. Right. I just take in pages at a time, which is why I can't learn French after like, 30 years. And, you know, like I struggle a lot. I can't read poetry. I've just finally given up. If it doesn't like rhyme and have stanzas, I cannot do it.
In what way? What do you mean you can't do it? Like your brain is just like, nope.
It's just my brain doesn't do it. It just doesn't process it. I really tried to like, and it was like Victorian poetry. It wasn't even like weird modernist. Like it was just, I was just like, I can't, it's asking too much of me, you know, it's asking me to think in a way, but I can like sit and read performances or movies and give you 40 interpretations, but I cannot read poetry. And I think it's all tied together. Sorry.
This is so validating because I mean, one of the reasons why I wanted to create this podcast, I mean, there's lots of reasons why, and there's lots of reasons why I like, this is my favorite thing I've ever done in my career, I think, is this podcast. Cause, I just love talking. I love talking about myself and I love talking about other people and their work. Mm-hmm. But one of the big reasons also, like that whole like demystifying thing is like, I have struggled with imposter syndrome, like my entire career, still can. And like, what I love about the format of a podcast is it's just much more relaxed, it's more authentic. It's like for articles, we spend so much time editing them. Like it's not like, even when you can say like, that's my Maggie voice, it actually, it's like, that's not the voice that like I know from high school. Right. You know, it's like, that's not the voice of you. Like when we're chatting here, that's your scholarly voice and it is your voice, but it's a different thing. And I think that it's, like being honest about our struggles, the more in my life that I've become honest about my struggles, the less I struggle. And it's like, I can just kind of accept and just hearing you talk about like, my brain just doesn't take in poetry. It's like, I could spend my time being like, I'm so stupid. I can't do this. I can't do this. And then it's like, no, I have ADHD. I can't do this. You know, it's like, it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with me. It just means like, I'm really good at connecting dots between ideas. Like that's my jam. I'm really good at being like, oh, this idea connects to this idea. Mm-hmm. But like, I cannot, like if you were to give me directions to like get from point A to point B, and it was more than walk straight ahead, I would be lost. Like my brain cannot retain that kind of information. So I just think it's like really helpful for people to understand that, you know, it's just like writing is editing, that like a lot of us come at research without fully formed, beautiful, like ideas, that this is all a process of growth. Mm-hmm. And that there are certain things that like, just because we're not good at certain things in doesn't mean that we have nothing to offer or that we're not brilliant in some other way. Like you are. That's my little, the more
you
know lecture.
So you're giving me permission to not be able to read poetry, even though I'm a PhD.
Totally.
Like any poetry, like not even hard poetry, Philip. I was like, I'm going to pay attention to every fucking word. Can I say? Oh, sorry.
Totally swear on here. And yet I want my university to promote this podcast sometime. Okay, and I'm always, but I say, I just, I already freaking. Said, I said, I already said the F word. It's just, nope.
Did you? Yeah, I wouldn't.
I know. You didn't notice.
I don't even, It's like every other word for me. So I'm
really like, same. The only word I say more than fuck is like.
So
like,
that's why it's like, hard to be authentic, because my authentic self says fuck every other word.
I know, okay. But this is also part of why I love doing this podcast, is because this is real. And this is what like academics, professors, like we need to be professional, but also it's like we're human beings and we're not the regular profs, Maggie. We're the cool profs.
We're the cool profs. Yeah. I think I just like, I mean, I don't want to go down. I'm really like trying not to go down rabbit holes, because every time you say something, I want to say something to like progress that. And so I'm trying not to do that. But I just have to say that one thing that aging, there's something about happened this past year. I turned 50 and
happy birthday.
Thank you. So, and I'm going through menopause, and which I'd rather talk about ADHD than talk about menopause.
Menopause, yes, it is destroying my brain.
Yeah. So I think if we, you know, get to the time, affects sort of my sex research too, and like why I'm changing tracks in my life. And so, I'm finally giving a shit a little less. And Phyllis, I think you and I are a lot like, yeah. Which like, you know, every time we talk, I'm like, wow, we are really, really alike. Yeah. Just why we probably like, I get along so well with Rosalie, because well, she's your like bestie. Yeah. But yeah, it's like, I try to not give a shit, like, but like you, I'm like, I don't give a shit. I really give a shit a lot. And I'm going to go cry.
Right. But everybody like me.
Yeah. I want everybody to like me. Yes, I absolutely do. Yep. But I'll be like, bullshit. But I'm really trying this year to sort of just be like, who do I have to prove something to anymore? I've done the things. I have a publication record. I have very good teaching evaluations. You know, my students say really, really nice things to me for the most part. You know, I'm just trying to be like, I don't have to prove myself as an academic anymore. But, and I know you felt this when you were young too, as the stupid kid.
Yes.
Oh my
God.
Family. Oh my God. You know,
everything was always Rosalie.
And I'm the fuck up. And we both ended up with like doing really well in academia. Yeah. You know,
because we're also
actually
stubborn.
Like academia, which it makes me really uncool. It just works really, really well for me. And I can't imagine myself doing anything else. But anyway, I'm trying to just be like, this is who I am, you know, and really, but you know, there are parts of my neurodivergence. I know not everybody loves that terminology, but that
is that a portmanteau or no? That's different. That's a scientific word.
Actually, it kind of is. Yeah, because it's a blended word in which one of the two stems, at least one of the two stems, is shortened. Okay. So neuro
would be like neurology. Like,
yeah. But then I'm like, is it just a prefix? I don't know.
Yeah. Interesting. And is that why we don't like it? Because I do want to get back to portmanteau words, but finish this thought and then we'll go back to it. So being neurodivergent.
In the ways that I am, there is some masking that I think that happens as well. So it makes it really hard to get to sort of like authenticity. And then I think as a critical thinker and a critical theorist, I'm like, what is authenticity?
Oh my
God.
You
know, everything is a performance. Like, what? So, you know, I'm just trying to like chill the F out and like, just like not hate myself who knows when I'm going to freaking die, you know?
Oh my God. Like, oh my God. I am having these. Yes. This is like my year. Partly why I'm on sabbatical this year is, like just to figure out like, who am I? What do I want? What am I doing? And I actually, you know, I often say like, oh, I hate academia or I don't want to be doing this, but I think I love it. I don't think I could be doing anything. Like I, this year could have chosen to do basically nothing. Like I could have, and yet I started a podcast and I'm working on three like articles, really kind of five articles. I'm like, I can't stop doing it. And it's like, and so what I'm trying to really figure out, like, what is it that I don't like? What is it that I struggle with? And I do think it has to do with the neurodivergence, but it like, One thing is, you know, the concept of rejection sensitivity dysphoria.
Yes.
I like just learned this and I'm like, what? Like between 70 to 100% of people with ADHD have this. It's like, I am like, because I can be very, like, I can be a leader. I can be in positions of authority. I can know what to do. But the second someone, like I witness somebody else experiencing this, or I experience it myself, of someone saying, you're doing it wrong, I will burst into tears. Like, it's just like, oh my God, I'm not doing it right. Like, and so I think there's this kind of like both this anxiety, but also like empathic anxiety that I experience, because we are, it is a field. It is a career in which we are constantly, like, it is literally our jobs to point out how everyone is doing it wrong. Like at all times, you know,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
our students, other, like the thing I hate about grading, I realized, like, sometimes it's like, yeah, the writing is bad, or it's like boring for people who don't give a shit, but we're like, my least favorite part of grading is having to like assign like a B+, where it's, you know, it's like the, like D or F, it's like, okay, yeah, this person didn't care. But a B+ is like, there was effort put into this. I feel bad. Like,
yeah,
it, like I will overthink it. It's like everything. It's like, there's so much overthinking. And so part of it is like there is a kind of like hating myself kind of thing, but there also is a like, I just want everybody to get a trophy. But I also am critical of the notion that everybody, it's like, no, everybody doesn't deserve a trophy. Like, you know, but then
that's,
it's like,
your
when
Gen
I'm
X coming through, we're, oh, like caught between that, like the sort of like silent generation of our parents, you know, our greatest generation, you know, and whoever they, wherever they fall, and yeah, the sort of toughen up, and right, and are the sort of like, soft and cushy millennials who followed us, you know? And so I feel both of those things. I'm constantly, right, like, toughen the F up. See how good I'm getting?
Good.
Toughen the F up and stop crying and nobody cares about your feelings. And right, oh my God, I'm a monster.
I feel so bad.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a really, yeah, it's a really tricky thing. There's like, oh my God, we have like started, I'm like just in my head imagined an outline of our conversation thus far. And it's like tree roots that are going in so many directions all at the same time. So let's get back. Let me try to focus us back, just because I really do
want
to.
So it's not a good time for me to ask you about. I'm like, oh, what's your new research? Oh my God, is it still breastfeeding? Oh. It's like, after, speaking of brilliant books that weave like wonderful interpersonal insights and, aww, empathy and critical theory together, Phyllis's book is tops.
Oh my God, did you actually read my book?
I did read your book.
Oh my God.
But I don't have it because I wanted to hold it up.
Aw, that's okay. Oh my God, I'm so touched. I feel like nobody read my book. Although I did, I went to, this is an interesting question, but I don't want people to get anxious about it. But I was feeling like, I went to the American Sociological Association meetings this summer, which I rarely do, but I was going just for a few day, like I was co-authoring a paper, and but I wanted to go to the I just got in the mail a report of like how many books from my publisher, like how many books I had sold. And I was like, I am a total loser because I have sold, it was like 400 books. And I was like, that is like, this is not the New York Times bestselling list or whatever. And I'm just like feeling sorry for myself. And so I went and I was like, I'm not going to do it. No, I'm going to do it. Like I went to the book fair and I'm like walking around and I was like, fuck it. I'm just going to, I mean, fudge it. I'm just going to ask someone and be like, so I go up, you know, casually to a publisher. And I was like, so like, what's considered like a successful number of book sales? And I was shocked. Dude, what would be your guess of what she said?
For an academic monograph.
Yeah.
Good number.
Yeah.
Phyllis, I don't know. 1,000?
2,000?
Are you serious?
100.
Oh, listen, I guess I had a good, I guess my book sold well. I mean, right? I didn't, if I sold 400, I got one check and it was.
Same, so, like $130.
Yeah.
So anyone thinking you're going to strike it rich being a scholarly book author, think again.
I have a funny story about Star and I trying to negotiate pay on our book, but I don't want to. I'll try to just make it really quick. So they approached us and so about writing the book, and so they sent the contract after we'll write up. We weren't thinking about doing this, but what the hell, let's do it. So we wrote up a proposal, sent it in, and when they sent the contract back, we realized that it was saying for both of, it was like anything that says author from now on is both of you basically in the contract. Okay. And then it's like the pay is $400. Okay. And we were just like, and I was like, well, certainly we could ask for 400 each, you know, but it was right. Like, no, it's 400. So we sent back. So somehow Star's like, well, my friends who write textbooks get this. We asked for something like $1,000 each. Okay. And she just wrote back and said, that's four times as much as like I would pay anybody. How about $450 for both of you? That's the top. And we just, and I was like, and Star just said, okay, we had to try, LOL. And she's like, hey, no. And so I'm like, I, of course, was like, Star's like, whatever, we should do it. And I was like, they're going to be mad at us.
I know. But right? They'll take it away.
Which and actually, then we realized, but let me just say real quick, $225 for a year's worth of work is what I'm worth. Okay.
You're worth so much more than that. But it is, like, that is a whole conversation we could have about, like, anyway, I don't want to go too far down there. And it's also, I have had sometimes students who say they like it when I'm kind of all over the place, mm-hmm. like, just because they identify with it. It's like how they think. And so it's, anyway, we can have more linear ones with, you know, everyone is different. That's okay. But I was just going to say too about like that sort of, you know, people, the ethics, partly the ethics of publishing and how much, you know, students or others don't realize how much work we do. Like we have our salaries that we're paid, but that, you know, you don't get any money for articles. You don't get any money for reviewing articles. Like occasionally you'll get like a few copies, like you can pick out of free books if you edit like things for a publisher that is, you know, like if they are writing a textbook, I've had that before. It's like, would you read these three chapters? And then mm-hmm. you can have $100 credit towards mm-hmm. our catalog of $100 books. and so, but it is an interesting question. Like it's not something I get that upset about usually, because I'm like, well, I get my salary and this is the job. Like this is what we do. But I do think it's something that people in the world at large don't really understand how research works, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, I think, like, people don't realize that the reason why we're doing this has nothing to do with the money that we're getting for it, because we don't get money. It's because, right. You know, we are curious. Like, we have some... Let's get back. I just want to get back to your book a little bit. I mean, I think to me, all of this stuff is relevant because really it is. I mean, what we're talking about is besides just our struggles to stay focused, but it's also about, I think a lot of what we're talking about is this kind of genuine curiosity about the world and about sort of teasing out and identifying the things that other people maybe haven't thought about, or things that, you know, might seem kind of obvious to others. And so, not to say that it seems obvious to others, things that we kind of have, it's really fun, I think, for both of us to challenge things that other people take for granted is like, oh, this is true. And it's like, you know, and it's like, well, let's actually dig into why that is that way. Like I was saying to my students recently, sort of my way of doing research often is just by saying why, like over and over again, like, well, why is this way? And okay, well, it's because of that. Well, why is that way? And so I just like, I'd love to hear a little bit more about like, so your article was about Megxit mm-hmm. and the ways in which that particular portmanteau was a way of sort of subtly or not so subtly communicating a kind of, you know, and it sounds clever and fun and it's like sort of, you know, cute in a certain sense, but it also is this way of reinforcing a kind of, you know, racist, colonialist, perhaps imperialist, like support for, you know, the UK or whatever for Britain. So what are some of the other portmanteau words that you're exploring in your book with Star Now?
Yeah, I was just like, oh shit, I should have looked up like what we're doing. Because we're just taking a break at the minute while Star finishes up the semester so we can work over the break unimpeded. Yeah. So I've just been planning my classes. But I think the most exciting one is probably Tradwife.
Oh my God, I have a student who just wrote a major research paper for like her final paper for her master's on tradwives. I find this fascinating. Tell me more about tradwives.
Well, I think we haven't fully written that. I've drafted a lot of the background on that. We haven't fully done the analysis of it. And it's been a while now. But that one, I think. So I think not all of them, Tradwife really announces itself. We kind of know. It's not a big Tradwife is articulated with patriarchy and white supremacy. And it's duh, whatever tradition. So it's not hiding anything really that some portmanteaus can do.
Right. And again, just for our listeners who don't know what tradwives are, this is traditional wives, right? And this is people on TikTok or whatever who are making these kind of ridiculous I wake up in the morning and then I make my children gruel and oats based on my field of oat making. I use my own oat milk and then my pureed dates from the date tree I planted in my right. That is sort of this return to traditional domesticity. Right?
Yes, that's very much it. But weirdly tied to it's got a huge aesthetic component that I think is mm-hmm. Really interesting what that aesthetic is. Is sometimes it's farmcore, and sometimes it's very Little House on the Prairie, and other times it's very I'm a 50s housewife. So the aesthetic thing is super interesting. And I think the aesthetic, I think part of what our argument is sort of leading to about the portmanteau is we all know all of the research pretty much so far is exploring how it takes on, it is used is based on ideologies of patriarchy and white supremacy. All right. So it's not we can't go in here and be okay, we're not going to reinvent the wheel. Right. So we want to really look at how the sort of history of traditional and the sort of history of wives, and that comes together. But the trad wife is an influencer largely. Right. So there's this complete it's at odds, right? We're not the first people who talk about this, but we want to sort of point out the mechanisms in language and communication that facilitate this kind of identity building through language, and so part of that works through a cognitive process of it's called conceptual blending. And so there's this, ways that we process this and end up with all these sort of new blended concepts. And so it's just so fascinating, I think, to us where we're where it's I'm here for my man. I'm here for my man. And a lot of times they're making the bulk of the money. They're the breadwinner in the family. And it's the Phyllis Schlafly thing, right? Mm-hmm. Women should be staying at home while Phyllis Schlafly is off having a very active political career. So that's how I always imagine it. So how do we get to traditional wife actually ends up to aesthetically driven influencer? Is
totally. It's what part of the 1950s were wives setting up a camera on their counter to their marble top counters to and pure white kitchen or whatever to, create their brand of, that's just, it's so just detached.
Yeah, it's weird. It's aestheticizing something that wasn't driven by aesthetics. And it's very strange. And it's really, really interesting. So I think that that is a really fun one to do. And one that I think that even though it's kind of seems really obvious that there's some interesting stuff.
I don't think it seems obvious. I don't think it seems obvious. And I think it seems really interesting. And it's all what I love about all of this is it it's like all of these examples are so effing stealthy. Like these are, it's like this really, it's like the right. Well, are there, it feels, I keep having all these arguments with my older kids about like politics and the election. And cause it's like, we share the same values and beliefs, but we have different analyses of like what explains the most recent election. Let's put it that way. And these can sometimes become very sort of heated discussions. But one of the things that I've been arguing is that the Republicans are, I think, really, really effective at developing like at rhetoric, like that they are very effective at sort of creating. And also I've been listening to, I just started listening to Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism, and which just for funsies, I just taking a break from true crime, which is the only thing I ever really listened to. But I was thinking about it with my son, Jack, who came over yesterday, and I was like, maybe is she like bad? I was like, I'm cooking dinner and I'm like, Google, like what are critiques of her? Like, what do I, anyway, so I found this bad critique. I'm like, no, I still love her. And but I keep pointing out to him and like and to my daughter too. I'm like there's a difference between ideology and research. And research means we're at least for me, I'm constantly trying to like prove myself wrong, instead of constantly just trying to find more evidence to support my claims. And my point about all of this is to say that one of the things in this critique of Arendt that the author was pointing to was this idea that her argument of what sort of leads to totalitarianism. And I think it's also in one of my favorite books, The Human Condition, which this is the third podcast I mentioned, episode I mentioned this, but she talks a lot about transcendence and this idea of like human beings are like trying to use technology to transcend the human condition. And that what totalitarian leaders are so effective at is transcending historic, like real historical context. And so she's wanting us to have this very like detailed historical, like understanding of particular events to see how like every event is kind of unique. And so we like, if we really understand that detailed history, we can understand it better. And what people on the right are so effective at is like sort of detaching their explanation. So it's like, we're going to stereotype and we're going to like create scapegoats of, let's say, I don't know, illegal immigrants, for example. And we're going to be like, we don't need to think about like the context that led to any of the reasons for why people are coming to this country. We don't need to look at like, you know, CIA involvement in Latin America. We don't need to look at any of that. We're just going to be like, these people are bad. And it feels like one of the things that you're pointing to with portmanteau words is this really, it's like so sneaky. It's like that it almost seems like these words are kind of a way that that transcendence happens. It's like this total, like this creation of a new word that evokes these racist, imperialist, like, you know, colonialist ideas, but completely erases it at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah.
And makes it so that people are like, oh yeah, I want to be a trad wife. That sounds fun. Like trad wives, it's like, no, I want to support my man. I love this because she's making like $1 million from her subscribers or whatever. So it's like, you know, what's fun about it is not that she's like a trad wife. It's that she's not a trad wife.
Right. Exactly.
You know? So it's like, again, this like this sneaky, and it's like what it seems like you're doing is you're like, no, no, no. Like, hold on. Hang on a second. You are trying to like create these slippages, this like, you're trying to create these areas of erasure, and I'm going to shine a light on it. It's like, no, I'm not going to let you erase it. I'm going to detail it. And I'm going to like, does any of that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like one of the reasons people get like frustrated with academics and are like, that's all bullshit, and like to pull up our, you know, work and make fun of it and shit like that. But like, I think one of the reasons that happens is that people imagine that by pointing this stuff out, that we are implying that everybody's like consciously being like, I'm going to slip my, you know, this is how I'm going to design this word and it's going to do these things. And it's, it may or may not be that. It's like rhetoric rhetorical criticism really was invested in finding people's motives last century. And you know, I've come to the point that like, we can't discern motive. Ultimately, we can like make arguments about it through traces in the document, but it's like whether or not somebody intends for this shit to happen, it does, because that's how language works. Hence, the portmanteau carries baggage, you know.
Like, oh my God, I love that. Maggie is just, for our listeners, is picking up. She is miming the picking up of a suitcase and carrying it, which I love.
Yeah, I keep forcing the metaphor of the portmanteau in the writing. So I'll be like, so we pick up the portmanteau and carry it through. You know, I like to sort of do that shit. But yeah, I think it's language is still, I mean, everything I do is about the significance, right, of language. I'm a scholar of language. And so the idea of intent or motive is ultimately not interesting to me. It's more like, I say impact necessarily, but just like, what can we trace in this moment that will feed into impact and reception and all these other things, you know? And what makes Tradwife pick up, you know, but something else, like we're going to talk about failed blends, you know, and ones that like don't work as well. I'm totally taking these from an article by Barbara Walraff. But like one of them is, but I remember what it meant, but one of them was like, I lie. It was like E-Y-E. L-I-E, but people would spell it like, pronounce it like Eile. It was supposed to be like something that looks different. I don't even remember what it was, but like somebody coined a portmanteau called ozone for the place in the dryer where your socks disappear. But it's like, well, that doesn't sound like
H-O?
Like hose. Yeah. Like,
oh, hose. Like pantyhose.
Like, yeah, like a blend of hose and
that
zone. Does not,
that takes way too much explanation.
Like, yeah, that's like a totally different one. So I mean, there's tons of them. Those are just the ones that pop up off the top of my head. I wish I remembered what I lie really was, because it was kind of fun. It was actually would have been a fun word, but no one's going to pronounce it that way. So that's all, like what linguists do is they're like, why do we pronounce things this way, and how do our brains make these, and how does our language system give rise to this, you know? And we're like, what does it do once it's embedded in language in various contexts?
Yeah. It's so interesting. I have two things I want to ask. One is, I realized I never finished my question because I went down a rabbit hole of Hannah Arendt. But my question is, do you think that it's accurate to say that Republicans or like conservatives are better at developing portmanteau words and creating these things? Like, do you think that there is, like, if there is a kind of ideology behind them, is that like more effective for certain political groups, or is it just that I pay more attention to them because they annoy me, whereas I'm like just not, like, is this like observation bias on my part? And then my second unrelated thing is, could you also in your book talk about iPads? Because when I was Googling,
I'm making a note.
When I was Googling what is a portmanteau, it kept saying like iPod is like that word. So it's, you know, and it started with, I don't even know how, but I just remember when the iPad came out, like it's kind of an example of like the inverse of what you were just saying, where I thought it would totally fail. I'm like, nobody is going to actually, no self-respecting person is going to say I have an iPad, because I could only think MaxiPad. And there was like a whole like joke about it on Mad TV or something back in the day.
Wow.
I know, right? It could have been Saturday Night Live, but I think it was Mad TV. Anyway, and yet now I'm like, you know, I just got a free iPad from my bank because I opened a new bank account. But anyway, so more importantly are there particular ideologies, I guess to rephrase it, that are better or worse at creating portmanteaus, or is it everybody does it? It's always happening.
All right. Well, caveat before I answer, this is not based on research, because I haven't really like researched that particular question. So it's more just like, it might be observation bias. I think they are way better. I think they're way better with language in ways that try to bypass deep thinking and as a way to sort of misdirect. And I think they're way better at creating sort of catchy buzzwords. And we are a catchy buzzword people, you know. Yeah. We are a viral people, and and I absolutely think so, right? I mean, I think like in trying to unpack Trump's charisma, clearly he is a charismatic leader, right? Like, not charismatic to me. I don't need to keep justifying. I have to say that he's charismatic, right? And I think if you look at him against like JD Vance, you understand like what that charisma is for people. But he's very good at that. And I don't know if it comes from him or you know, his speechwriters. Yeah. It doesn't really matter. But is that kind of misdirection with and buzzwordy speech? And in general, yeah, I don't think liberals or Democrats or progressives, even though we're not all the same thing, know how to do that, partially because there's like a carefulness.
Yes. I remember when I was in grad school at the University of Iowa. I mean, it still is happening all the time, but I remember a particular moment where a lot of politicians were like, universities are just full of liberals, and this is about bias, that no one will hire conservatives into academic positions. And my argument has always been like, maybe it just is like, universities are full of complex thinkers it's our job to think in complicated and nuanced ways. And it just doesn't lend itself, you know, there's certain concern, like, I don't think that every single conservative idea is like simplistic or bad or anything. I mean, I don't know. Like, I at least in principle, I would like to think that like, I don't want to be an ideologue about my ideologies, but like, I just like, there are certain things that are like, you know, they're complex, you know, like, you know, Adam Smith, like The Wealth of Nations is not like a simple to read book, right? Like, it doesn't mean I necessarily agree with it, or that I think all of the like logic behind it is completely, you know, accurate, and there could be but it's, you know, everything isn't a buzzword. Like, you don't have to be, you know what I'm stumbling here, but it's like, you can have complex ideas and come out of that with, you know, whatever political ideology you might, you know, sort of lean towards. But at the same time, I do think, like, when we start as I was saying before, it's like my sort of overarching methodology is, say, well, why is it? You know, like, that's how I got into my research on breastfeeding. It was because it's a way of sort of challenging our assumptions. So it's like, people are like, well, breast is best or whatever. And I'm like, well, is it? Like, let's look at the research. Like, why do we think it's the best? Like, where did that come from? What are the, like, if we ask why a lot, there's a lot of room and potential for disrupting the status quo, and disruption of the status quo is inherently not conservative, because like, conservative means like, you know, like not wanting change. And so if you want things to stay the same or how they used to be, it's like, it's not going to help to ask why a lot, because it's like, you know, it sort of lends itself to saying like, it just is, okay, just accept it. So
that makes me think of two things. One, like, breast is best is, you know, like, linguistically, you know, it's catchy as hell, and it's got the internal rhyme, and it's got the bilabial plosives, and it's got the, you know, like, not
breast and best,
and you know, there's the sound symbolism between the two words is powerful. So sound symbolism is something also that portmanteaus work off of, right? And so you can't like pretend this stuff is not happening. You can't make anything with exit and a blend and not have it call back originally to Grexit, you know, like, you can't say I'm not drawing on those. So I was just thinking about sound symbolism there. And the second thing, there was not me who said this. I don't remember where I heard it, but on a podcast, I heard something It might have been If Books Could Kill. I'm not sure.
I love that podcast.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But they were talking about how, conservative or not conservative, I'm sorry, conspiracy thinking is like research and critical thinking for stupid people. It's like research for stupid people, you know, like, because you have a way, and to make it kinder, right? If you have a segment of the population who feels disenchanted with academia or distanced from it, giving something that people can feel super smart about, like, you don't know the real history, because academics are always coming in and being like, but you don't really know what you're saying, right? So that conspiracy theories, like the QAnon shit, and part of that is it gives people a way to feel like they're super educated about this one thing without having to have any of the sort of like rigor or standards that academic research ideally should have.
Yes. I giggled when you said for stupid people. I want to retract my giggle only because it was funny how you said it. But because I've been actually talking with Willow, my daughter, who's editing this podcast, and one of the things that I think is so like what has led to the rise of basically totalitarianism again in the United States and like, you know, populist movements, you know, one of the things I think is this sense of like, you hear it a lot of this, like, oh, you know, Democrats or academics, they think they're so much smarter than everybody, like exactly what you're talking about of like, but you don't really know. And, you know, universities are very inaccessible to a lot of people, especially in the United States due to the cost, but also just to the like, you know, the habitus, like that if your parents didn't go to university, you didn't go to university. Like it's a thing to like be to sort of go against that grain. But it also, I think there is this bias against, like a bias towards intelligence that doesn't get talked about very much. It's like, you know, there's like all the, you know, like anti-fat bias, feminist research, like there's racism is bad, but it's like, this is going to sound so ridiculous, but nobody is talking about bias against stupid people. And it sounds so ridiculous to say, because it is so like, there is this like this unquestioned assumption that the best thing to be is smart, that it is that we all have to be smart. And if we are not smart, if we don't know something, that not like to be stupid is to have zero value. It is to be completely like useless. And
really, I do not see this country as one that like, I mean, we don't spend any money on education. We don't value critical thinking.
I'm not saying education. I'm not saying that there is, but I'm saying that people want to be smart, but they're not doing anything without it. And so what I think Trump is doing, this is my argument, is that what Trump is doing is he is providing value. He is telling people they are still good. Like they don't have to be smart. Like you don't have to go to school. You don't have to put money into education. You don't have to like all of these things. Like these people think like to be smart, you have to go to university and you have to be educated, but you can be like, you're just as good if you are like, if you are, you can think whatever you want and still be smart.
No, I fully agree with that. Yeah, I do. And I mean, like backtrack a second, like I'm very, very mad right now. And so I do think people who vote for Trump are stupid. And I don't think that stupidity has to do with education at all in this sense. I mean, there's plenty of conspiratorial thinking in academia, you know? And so I just want to clarify myself that that's not like to devalue anybody who has, you know, different levels of education or different levels of education or natural intelligence, whatever you want to say, aptitude. I agree with what you're saying.
This is what I want people to take away from this episode and this podcast, that it is okay. And it is not just okay, but it is important that we let ourselves be stupid, that we let ourselves like have ADD, that we let ourselves be human, because it is when we think we have to be superhuman that we end up with conspiracy theories, or we end up with just like garbage, because we are trying to like prove that we know things. And it like that, it's just, that's not what research is about. And it's like, let's call ourselves stupid, like not like own, like not like deeply internalize it, but be like, that was a bad idea.
That's a bad idea. And I didn't defend it. And what am I saying? That's what we should be doing. And I think that like one of the things that you had put on the script was to talk about, you know, writing and things like that. And I think like a big move, at least in the latter half of the 20th century, and how I came up, was that you take a stance and you defend it, and you, yes, you know, and I'm trying to like get away from that. And my book, I tried to really get away from that and just be like, so rhetorical criticism used to really be about like making your argument, like this is the reading, this is the preferred reading. And mm-hmm. now it's more like, you know, this is an opening, this is a reading, you know, this is a reading that we hope leads to other readings mm-hmm. of it. And so I think that like that posturing of go in and make an argument and like leading with an argument, and I'm a rhetorician, you know, but I'm like, I don't think we should lead with analysis rather than argument, even though they're analysis is argument, argument is analysis, you know, we can go back and forth with that. But I think like pulling back and leading with a little curiosity and, you know, exploration is something that I think can help students. And one other thing that I thought would be interesting, and this is sort of back on track, is that I try and teach rhetorical analysis, and my whole program is into this, that analysis is research, right? Like,
yes,
people don't think that it is. And so I'm really invested in the idea, like, I don't like being like, our program doesn't teach research, or I don't teach research in here because we're not going to the library and looking at the databases or doing interviews. I'm sorry, but analysis is research. You are deeply looking into something. You are posing questions. You are trying to find answers. And so even if it's research into just like, even if you don't, you do like old school close reading, you are researching that text, you know?
Yes, I love that. And I remember you had said in an email, you're like, well, I'm not really doing human subjects, so I don't know if you even want me on your podcast. And I was like, you are totally doing research. But I also, like, as someone who is trained to like go into the databases, like a lot more of my ideas and my thinking is much more analysis. And I think I've been hesitating, or like I'm struggling to just do it and to sit down and like do that writing. Cause I'm like, well, this, does this count? Is this like, this isn't what I was trained to do. Like, is this real? And then I like, when I'm looking for other articles or for other ideas, it's like, I find, you know, or it's like, I'm listening to the Hannah Arendt book and I'm like, this is so valuable. Like, this is helping me understand the world. Like, this is helping me make sense. And it doesn't mean like, you have to have like a survey where, you know, cause you can't, like, you can't, under, like, you're not going to answer the origin, like, what are the origins of totalitarianism by running a goddamn social survey, like standing around with a clipboard and being like, what are you, like, that's the worst kind of research, like survey question ever in terms of survey design, is asking the participant to tell you why. So it's like, there are certain questions that can only be answered through analysis and by thinking and by questioning and by, you know, challenging each other. And I love that idea. And I also, I want to go back to, like, you know, when you were talking about just your first point about the idea, I just want to turn to about this idea of like having to have an argument. Cause I think that like what you're talking about is a really nuanced idea. And I'm really like, everything you're saying, I'm like, oh my God, yes. And then I'm also like, but I always am telling my students, you need to have an argument. You need to have a point. Like, yeah, you don't want the writing to be just like, here's like a Wikipedia summary of like a labor review. So like, like, can you just talk? Because you teach writing.
Yeah.
And like, you know, one of my questions was like, what is good writing? What is bad writing? Does such a thing exist? I say yes, but I want to hear what you have to say. But like, just tell me more of like, expand on those ideas.
Well, I mean, obviously, like, they have to have an argument. I mean, like fully like claims evidence analysis over here and thesis statements and thesis driven arguments. I think it's more the like posturing that comes around, like, in order to make an argument, yeah, I have to sort of just look up, find everything that supports my thesis.
Yeah.
As opposed to the thesis being a true hypothesis.
Yes.
Of this is where I've arrived at this moment, you yeah know, and I am open. You can make an argument without saying like, this is the answer. You know, yes, again, it's the sort of like, this could be an answer or this is an answer. And that still has to be, you know, like, yeah, argued, and it still has to be like cohesive, and it still has to like be warranted, you know, and yeah, supported and all that thing. It's still, it's like the idea that I have to just sort of like get behind, mm-hmm, what my thesis is and just like pound the hell out of it to sort of, in my field, there's like a really interesting to me debate in the field of composition studies and a lot of teaching around students being taught to sort of act like academics before they are academics. Mm. You know, I can't believe Bartholomew. Okay. And now I'm blanking on his first name, but Bartholomew was writing about how kids kind of like come into college and bullshit college pros. And we ask them to do this. We ask them to pretend that they are academics. And we ask them with like, and that's how they learn, right? They try it on, but they fumble through it so badly.
Totally.
Because they don't know the difference, because like making a solid argument, they haven't quite understood that that's not just, you know, twisting everything to sort of make it prove what you've decided your thesis is before you did any research, you know?
Right, totally.
And so like a lot of the stylistic stuff comes from, I read academic prose and it's confusing. Therefore, yeah, my own prose.
Right? Oh my God. I totally remember. I remember confusing when I was an undergrad, and I remember like the rare occasion that I actually read a paper after printing it. I remember reading sentences or working on them being like, I don't understand this, but I bet the professor will.
And your like, professor's like, what the actual...
Right. It's like, here's my tip to all listeners. The professor did not understand.
No, they just assume that you need to make yourself clear. That would help. I tend to be a really easy grader, but a kind of sarcastic commenter. So sometimes now with students that know me really well or had me a lot, I'll just use like emojis. Like there'll be a cliche and I'll be like, just like, do the like straight line across or the cringing face a lot. I'll be like, what the hell? I mean, I don't do that to all my students, but like if they've worked with me for a long time, like, you know better than this. Come on now. But yeah.
So you were saying that like there's this debate, and I find that fascinating, of students like in composition studies that students come in, we're asking them to sort of, it's like play dress, it's like fake it till you make it, pretend to sound like an academic, but they don't really know how to do it. So what are people saying should be done instead?
Well, just for everybody in composition studies, the thousands of compositionists who are listening to your million listener podcast, this is a debate from last century, and I don't do composition studies, you know, so I don't like at all know what the current like thoughts about teaching college writing are.
Yeah.
Because it's just not where my research is. Like,
right. But you do teach college writing.
I do. So I do all the time, you know, so yeah, I don't know what conversations are having about it. But I think that like, so, it was like a debate between Peter Elbow and David Bartholomew, and it was,
oh, thank God you mentioned them, cause I was like judging you.
No, I had to pull the names up. No, but like Bartholomew's point, I think it was just to like sort of point out that this is happening and sort of do some close reading of student texts and try to understand what they were doing. And what we read as bad writing is really them trying to try on this academic suit, you know, and
interesting.
That can be instructive to us to sort of understand, you know, that it's not that you read this and then you suddenly are able to, you know, produce academic prose.
I love
that's
this.
Like my, I don't remember what the ultimate argument, that is what I took away, is that, I mean, I'm trying to get away from like this. I just feel like it's leading to bad writing when they're just standing behind and pounding this like thesis into it. Around, like, and like some, like, that's not how it works. Like
every single episode I keep turning the conversation to like AI and people's thoughts on AI because like doing it about writing. But I also like there's a colleague of mine who is at the Institute of Feminist and Gender Studies, but she's a historian. I'm going to have her on. I'm going to be interviewing her in a few weeks. And I know that, and I'm very curious, like she and I've had a lot of conversations about student writing and frustrations with like what students know, and like graduate students, not just undergrads, of like, they don't know what a journal article is, like, or what the difference is between like a book chapter and a journal or something. And she's like, how is it that they don't know this? How is it that they haven't learned this? And also in my department, like we've had lots of department meetings of people being like, students don't know how to write. We need to have, you know, and there's been lots of, like, when I was chair at the Institute of Feminist and Gender Studies, we talked about, well, you should introduce a writing course. And there's like, but it seems to me that there's a lot, it's like everybody seems to have a sense that student writing is on the decline, or I don't know if it ever was knew what they were doing, but that student writing is insufficient and AI poses an existential threat to student writing. But everybody also, it seems, other than like this colleague, she has been introducing a lot of like sort of remediation in her courses. So I'm not speaking about her, but like other people that I've heard talking about this, it feels very much like they are pointing at other people who should be. It's like, I want students to come into my class as fully formed writers and I want them to be good writers. And so what is wrong with everybody else? But like, so I'm just curious, like you teach writing, like, is that like, my thinking is, I'm always trying to teach all my students about writing, no matter what the class is. And partly how I do that is with like very clear rubrics, but there's a lot that it doesn't occur to me. I'm like, oh, they didn't know that. Like, and it's like, I don't know. Like, what are your thoughts? Like how, like, what's this? What is your experience teaching writing? What are the things, like, does any of that make sense? What are your thoughts on any of that?
Yeah. I have like 4,000 thoughts, which means I will express
That's why
none
you're
of
here.
Them. Shit. Okay. So just a caveat before we start talking about AI, have done no research again in this area besides talking to ChatGPT. And
I use it. Like it's,
my bestie. I mean, I've had like 3 besties in this conversation, but yeah, no, like I've kind of like turned it into sort of like, you know, I don't know. So I haven't done it. This is all just experiential.
That's why thoughts. You're here.
Okay, so the first thought, which I do think is interesting, again, I have to like put on my composition education from 2005, and talk about that. So the whole like student, it's like the Johnny can't write thing is a kind of like a moral panic, and it resurfaces in the country. Like it's one of the reasons why we have composition studies. Like Canada doesn't have composition studies. You don't go and learn English 101. You know, you don't take first year comp. Well, you don't take first year comp, do you?
Yes, exactly. They get English. Okay. No. Yeah. You're right. They get English 101. They don't get composition. Yeah. Like, and in high school they get English. Like my kids who are like, my stepson is in grade 12 English and they're reading Shakespeare and all, and that is great. But I'm like, I did AP composition with Ms. Hayworth. Like I don't remember. Like I still draw, like I learned so much in that AP composition course that I get very frustrated. I'm like, why? Like there is a problem in the Canadian educational system, I think, in the high schools in like K to 12.
Yeah.
That it's very still, I think, like it's 1975 and creativity is key. Anyway, yeah. Carry on.
Well, I think that, so it's also tied into like a lot of times, so the panic around it emerges. Like I'm sure that there's research on how often it emerges and how, under what conditions it emerges. It's like satanic panics, you know, they come up to like periodically. So now this is not to say that there's not a problem with writing. It's more to say that it's kind of always been there. And yeah. When it resurfaces, it's very common for it to resurface with a technology that that changes writing in some
this
way.
Is what I'm saying.
Okay.
This is what I'm saying.
So, anyway. So I think that like my first, at first I was just like not paying attention to it all. I'm like, whatever. Like, I'm not going to like go through. And I had a friend who was just like obsessively tracking it down. And I'm like, they spent an hour grading a paper to prove that they cheated. I'm like, why do you care that much? Like, just grade it. I grade it. Like, I just wouldn't put the effort into it. So no. I can't be asked with tracking down every, you know, like instance like
I'm
that.
Not
but
a
anyway,
cop. I keep saying that.
I'm not a cop. I'm not at all, you know? Yeah. So anyway, so like part of me was like, whatever, it'll sort itself out. Right. And then, I think I started like, I started using it myself and I was like, oh, shit.
I know.
There is like, I've been getting AI writing and I could almost like sense exactly when it was coming in. And then that bothered me. Right. So.
Yes. Oh, yes. Which is, I was just on a podcast as a guest talking about, because I have zero expertise. I just have a lot of thoughts on AI. So every me time too. You're like doing these caveats, I'm like, this is how I am. But, yeah. But this is, I totally believe. Professors need to be using AI. And my colleague, Mireille McLaughlin, actually said this too. We need to use it so we know how students are using it. But the more I use it, there are certain phrases that are like, oh my God, it's like AI has a voice.
In this document. Yeah.
Right. It's like, so like hyperbolic and just like, this is amazing. Like there's certain phrases. It's weird.
It does have
it's
a
like,
voice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
for
weird.
Sure. And I understand it. And also when I started using it, I was like, holy shit, I can have it summarize an article before I go teach it. And I can have it come up with discussion questions. You know what I'm terrible at, Phyllis? Discussion questions. Like, I mean, now I'm using it and I'm like, yeah. I'm going to use it for this. I'm using it to like, like create summaries, like I said, of articles I write. But then also I'm like putting these summaries into Microsoft OneNote, and then I tag them and I cross-reference like this article, you know, text. And it's an enormous help. I like pay for the AI version of this program called UPDF. And it's like, I don't ever want to, but I don't want it to write for me. Like, I can't stand the, like, when we talked about Grammarly was on the notes.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on Grammarly?
I hate it taking out all of my, I mean, sometimes I'm like, all right, you know, you can make that change, but no, I want some stylistic flair here. And
I've never used Grammarly only because I'm cheap. So I'd never,
it just pops up whether I want, no, I don't pay for it. Okay. It just like in Google Docs, it just, I have it on, I think I have it, the plugin installed somewhere.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But even Microsoft Word now is like concision. And I'm like, I'm all for concision, but it's not the end all be all, you know, like I ultimately think that academic writing should be good writing and that not enough of academic writing is good writing. And yes, I do believe there is such a thing as good writing.
Yes. Yeah. So. Yeah. So what is good writing and what is bad writing?
I mean, I think it's like all the, it's probably not even anything. I think that good writing, like, tells a story of some kind, you know. I think good writing is cohesive. Yes. You know, I think that good writing is in whatever way you can somewhat reflective of something in you, you know, in whatever way. I don't like people feeling so, now I've had this when I first started publishing, like people, I think I talked about this maybe on the last public, like you don't use the word asshole. And I'm like, really? You know, but like good writing should allow you to use the word asshole as part of developing your voice, you know?
Right. This is why I am not working as hard as I could to get rid of all the times I say fuck on this podcast.
Sorry. I mean, I'm just not being good.
No, this is who we are.
This is who I am. And I think for, and this is like for academic writing, I'd like academic writing to be closer to sort of like creative writing. And I'd like to have, like, I really am invested in sort of destabilizing the creative academic divide, that like academic writing can be bad. It shouldn't be bad. It should still be like understandable. I think good writing seeks connection with its audience. I think good writing seeks, now this is not necessarily true of creative writing, has different goals, right? But but for other writing, informative writing, scholarly writing, you know, you should be, you should be seeking, even seeking complication in clear ways, you know, like, so I'm just like really invested in what kind of connection can I make with the audience? And I think part of that is through, at least in Stripped, wanting to sort of take out that thing and say, no, I slept with research subjects, you know, like, I am bad, you know, like, you know, whatever, just to sort of like say, I have to step out of that academic posture every once in a while, you know?
Yeah, I love that. It's why I love the format of the podcast, because it really facilitates letting us, like, allowing ourselves to be part of our research like that, and to think about these ideas in their sort of roughness, in their, like, in their full humanity, and like not this sort of fake, inauthentic posture of like, we're just really formal and do everything perfectly and look at this beautiful final product. But at the same time, it's like, I think a lot about like the editing of podcasts, and I was really editing one, like the episode with Tyler, cause we were talking about sex a lot, and I was like going to release it, and then I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be canceled. And so I went back in and I was like listening, and I was like, okay, what did I say? Like, I realized that because of my style of speaking, it sounded a little bit like I was saying at one point that I think that having sex with your mother is hot. Because he was talking about MILF porn, but it was like,
are you talking about like family porn? It's really popular right now. I'm having a moment.
It is. Listen to that episode. But
I will. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so good. But it was like, because I was all excited and I had all these thoughts at once. So I was like basically speaking like three thoughts. And what the sound came out of my audio player was, I totally get it. I get, like, you know, moms, like, sex with, like, power is hot. It's, it was some convoluted thing. And so it's, I appreciate beautiful edited work. Like, as we were saying, like, good writing is, like, I think good writing is, we're considering our audience and we're also considering the format. Like, it is, what is the, like, venue for this writing? And that we want to be writing, you know, we're talking, like, the rhetoric is going to differ depending on where it is located. Like, and I think partly it's, like, our expectations. Like, what is it that we're expecting? And sometimes, if we disrupt those expectations, it leads to some really cool ideas. And sometimes it just is so, like, you know, there's like Philip Glass, and then there's like my kid playing on a, you know, a xylophone.
Yeah, for sure. There are disruptions that absolutely don't work, you know, and they're like, you know, and maybe when I was an early writer, I didn't do it as well. And that's why I got flagged for it. You know, I don't know, but there are certainly, yeah, like, that doesn't mean that I'm like, you know, I do go in and I'm like, why are you saying this? You don't say this in academic prose. Like, we don't do that.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, I think that learning, so, you know, it's like the questions, like, it's hard for students because the way that you have to do, the way you do good scholarship is that you write a million drafts, you know, like I have 50 drafts of articles that I published, you know, because I'm hyper, I save everything.
Totally. Oh, there's one very practical tip, totally, for students. If you, like, you got to kill your darlings, you got to kill the words, but like create out files. I do this all the time, is like put an out file, copy, like cut it, paste it there. And then you don't have to, like, you can someday reuse it. Usually I don't, but occasionally I do, but at least I know it's there.
Yeah, there's times that I've been working on things and I've gone back and I do it. I don't copy it into a second document, which I probably should. I just save a new version. So I'll be like version 26 after I've cut something. But years later, I'll like Google something and it'll be like a section that I cut out and never put back in. And I'm like, oh, I have use for this now.
Yes.
But it's like when you're taking five classes, four classes, even graduate students, you don't have time to work on an article for a year. You know, you don't have a time to edit for a year. So the students who end up, so that sort of natural writing ability, which I do think that, I mean, I don't know how natural it is, but there are people who it's way easier for. Than others. But I always think writing's teachable. And that's what gets me really excited about it, because I learned how to do it from teaching it. I think I was a fairly good writer just from growing up with the parents that I did. And, you know, they read to us and everybody was a big reader in my family. And, you know, my parents were upwardly mobile and sort of, you know, were like really careful about, you know, wanting us to be like educated and thoughtful. So like a lot of stuff like came from my background, but I didn't know why I was doing things. It was like, well, I know what sounds right. And then I started teaching grammar. A nightmare. But now I know it. And once the more I knew it, the more like it's like somebody had given me some kind of secret code. And when I learned about how you can structure a paragraph to make it cohesive using like the no new contract, and how you could, there's stylistic devices that people have been studying for 3,000 years. Can like pull people into your writing and, you know, and I get super excited. And my students ultimately are like, I learned from that, you know, I want to demystify the writing process in whatever way that I can. And I think that that translates into other thinking and other writing that my students go on to do. And the feedback shows that it is.
Yeah, no, 100%. I would say two of the classes, maybe three classes that were the most important to me in high school, two of which are never offered in Canadian schools, typing, driver's ed. You have to pay for driver's ed here in Canada, and then AP English. But it's like the things that, like, you know, there's plenty of other things that I learned, but it's like those fundamental skills, like, and especially with the AP, like AP English was composition. It is under, and I was saying this on the episode with Mike, it's like they're, you know, everyone wants to write like Sarah Ahmed, or like is trying to copy Judith Butler or someone like that. But it's like, there's very basic conventions of writing and like you can play with those, but you have to understand what they are first. You know, it's like you know, it's like Picasso, like, you know, his little painting of a peace dove or whatever. It's like, you know, he had this whole series of paintings that were just like single line drawings long before he became, but it was like there's classical training that goes into that. Like, you're not just like drawing stick figures and like then becoming able to write like with very just a few lines something beautiful, right? Like you have to get the foundation of it. So for students or like people who are struggling with their writing, like I love that you're saying like people can learn it. What are some things, and I was looking at your website, there's writing stuff, because doingsocialresearch.com, I do have some things like a formula for an introduction, and like what you were just saying, I'm like, I don't know anything. Like I'm way less of any kind of an expert in any of this than you are. And it's sort of like, I just picked it up, or one thing like a paragraph. Oh my God. I was a professor when I learned that, like I was teaching a research methods class, and I brought in, we had a writing center. This was at Acadia, and we had a writing center, and the guy who ran it, Stephen Ahern, was in the English department, such a smart guy. And I invited him in to just talk about like, how do you write a paper in the second year class? And he was like deconstructing a paragraph. And I was like, oh, a topic sentence? I didn't know that was, and I'm like so embarrassed now. But so I'm always like to students, like, do you have a topic sentence? But it's where for those who are students or professors in their careers and still don't know what a topic sentence is, where should I send, where should, what would be helpful, do you think? I mean, besides taking your class in upstate New York, what else can they do, would you say?
Can I answer another question first?
Yeah, totally.
This is like really, because I'm thinking about it and I want to answer it. One thing that I think faculty can do better, and this is not for our own writing, but probably ultimately for our own writing, because when you teach writing, you learn, right? I mean, that's just that's just it. Like, but I think that that's sort of like, I don't want to say every other department, but being in like a composition studies or writing and rhetoric or whatever it's called, it's like students come into my class and they can't write. And I'm like, but why would your students know how to write in a 300 level history class? Like, why would they? That's sort of like, they don't know how to write. I'm like, no, they don't know how to write in that context. Oh. All right. You can't fully like say that they can't write because obviously they write all the time.
Interesting.
So literate, you know, time in culture because of like typing constantly, you know? So, yeah. So this sort of like idea that somehow their education would have prepared them for disciplinary writing is kind of bizarre to me.
I was thinking about that. Cause again, I was talking with my son, Jack, and my stepson, and they were just sort of talking about, cause they, you know, like what are they reading? Cause you know, in the Ontario curriculum, and I realized, and we were just talking, I think like Jack and I were just talking about academic writing because Jack is a sociology major and Finn was like, well, I know how to write. And then we were sort of talking about like scholarly writing and it became clear that it's like he has been taught how to, he's like, my teacher said compare and contrast is like the most important thing you'll ever need to know. And I was like, huh, like, I was like, I don't know about that. I was like, you know, that is useful, but I think maybe in literature, I don't know. Like, I have no idea where that came from, if that was like the teacher, but I'm like, that's really like, that's not what we do. And
it's not at all. When you get a paper and you're like, heart sinks because they're like, in this paper, I will compare and contrast.
Right. And it's like, but it's also realizing like that teacher, like in high school, they're not being taught. Like, you know, if they're taking, there is a high school, like sociology, anthropology, psychology course that they take, that's the social science, but they're not learning how to write how to do scholarly writing. They're learning about like, you know, what the various, you know, what is impression management or, you know, they're learning concepts. They're not learning how do you create the research like that. And to me, this is what we are supposed to be teaching them this in university, like in college.
I think like just then to actually answer the question that you posed originally is what can we all do to sort of improve our writing? And I think that like one, understanding, you know, that believing that your writing always can be improved. Is one thing. But also just like there are some basic moves that you should be making. And if the end of this sentence is totally a world away from the beginning of this next sentence,
oh my God, yes.
You've got a problem, you know? Yeah. And so I think that those are things that, regardless of discipline, that you can be like, what's the point of this paragraph? I have students do a lot of reverse outlining where after they have a draft, they sort of pull out what claim. So I talk a lot about claims more than topic sentences. But what claim, and the claim should be supporting the thesis, right? There's a thesis. What claim is it making? How is it warranted? Or what evidence, the students hate the term warranting. Warranting, like you have to warrant your claims. Like you have to support them.
Right. Like, what is your evidence? This is why
what's your evidence? So I just claim evidence analysis a lot. And then sort of like in the analysis section that you're sort of showing how does the evidence support the claim, you know? So, like claim evidence analysis doesn't work for like every obviously genre of writing, but I think just sort of understanding like cohesion on a really basic level, just Google cohesion and think about cohesion and ask yourself, how did I get to the beginning of this sentence? Is a huge thing. Yeah. So just like as a quick and dirty tip, understanding cohesion and understanding transitions, which is part of it, like between sentences, not just between paragraphs, between words, between sentences, between ideas, you know, between paragraphs, between you know, just like.
And that if you find yourself, I keep saying this message, if you find yourself saying, as previously mentioned, or as I will talk about later, I'm like, take that bit that you're going to talk about later, like put it together. Like
put it together.
You know, it's like bouncing around, like you're going to this idea and then like you're going to A and then B and now you're to C. But wait, now we're back at A and now we're at B, up back at A. It's like that bouncing around It's so, I mean, I do it still. Like, my sister edited the first version of my book and really helped me, because I think sometimes too, it's like you have all of these ideas, you've read all this material. Like, if you're doing it right, it's like you have all this stuff and you're like, how do I make any sense of this? Mm-hmm. And sometimes, because editing is right, or writing is editing, it's like I'm going to throw it all on the page. Mm-hmm. And then I realize, wait, these ideas are all like, mm-hmm. sometimes that editing is just being like, okay, wait, let me group my ideas together. And it can be hard because it's like, it feels like, no, these are totally separate ideas. I'm like, no, that's actually just the same thought, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's because you read your shit. So, right. I mean, people also like, how do you get better? You have to read it. Like, you really have to read it. And I really encourage, yeah. If students really, if they actually care, they'll do this, like find a place and read it out loud. Like you should, I try and write everything now. And I learned this from giving presentations at conferences, and I got better and better at it because I wrote everything to be read out loud. Mm-hmm. And now if I stumble over a sentence, I stop and I edit it, you know, nice. And, you know, sort of being like, there is something that's causing you to trip on that sentence. And so when you trip, when you're reading it, like, why am I tripping? You know, like, could this be said better? And so many times students will be like, I'm like, why did you say this? And they're like, I don't know. And I'm like, okay. So like being like, huh, you know, and which I do too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then we have to solve that problem.
Yeah.
So
totally.
Reading your stuff, yeah. Understanding cohesion, yeah. And, transitions. And those are, yeah, all like together. Those are like three ways that anybody can improve whatever kind of writing, you know, yeah, they're doing.
Totally. Totally.
And then read in your discipline, you know, and then, yeah, like also like there's so much stuff on the web. Like, just like sometime, Phyllis, have you ever done like writing a social science article?
Mm-hmm.
Tutorial. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, like, I'll do that still. I'll like, yeah, look up tutorials for writing the humanities or writing a lit
tutorials.
Review.
I've like, you know? I've looked at, like, for websites that talk about different stuff. If I'm trying to like, how do I explain this? Like,
yeah, I mean, there's a lot of like online writing labs that, okay, will do this kind of stuff. Different OWLs. Purdue OWL is like overtaken by ads. So it's kind of, that's okay, the famous. I really like it's called the Excelsior OWL. And it's really clean. I like it a lot. But yeah, just like Googling stuff and like figuring out, like reading, yeah, what people say, just like teaching it is like anything else that, yeah, you have to learn. And maybe, yeah, teaching it as a form, writing as research, you know, helps them get into that sort of like,
yeah,
framework. But it's hard. Like, I really have to push that writing is the thing, because, yeah, students, and especially in academia, think that they're writing about the thing, that there's something different that they're trying to get to,
mm-hmm,
that the writing is just a vehicle for.
Right.
Does this,
right,
make sense? Like, they want writing to be a transparent medium for what's in their head, as opposed to writing constructs your argument, right? Writing doesn't.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like,
totally.
It's not like your argument is fully formed in your head and it's beautiful and you just need to find the right way to get it out. It's like, no, yep, when you make choices,
yes,
on the page about organization and diction and all that stuff, you are formulating an argument,
yes, or
in that moment.
Yes, yes. And Howard Becker also, I always try to put references on my website for this. I don't know if it shows up on like Apple Podcasts, but if you go to website, doingsocialresearch.com, under the podcasting section, there'll be references to everything. But that I remember to, I might forget things anyway, but it is absolutely in the process. Like he says very clearly, it's like, we're not, and that's again, why the editing is what matters. It's not the first thing. It's because it's when we're writing that we figure out what the hell it is that we're trying to say. And I think that so often too, sometimes that comes because I say something, and like, this is why I think citing is so important. It's not just about giving credit to people. It's not just about being like, not taking credit for it, but it's, I have to go back and be like, wait, did they really say that? Like, mm-hmm, I have to go back and look at it and be like, oh shit, I've been saying like this thing and I thought that was from that guy, but it was actually this other guy and he was saying all this other stuff. Like that there really is this process, like all of these things that kind of feel like, oh, it's just like, you know, why do I have to get my citations right? Or why do I need to do this or that? And it's like, actually, because that is clarifying and deepening our thinking and our understanding of these ideas. No,
yeah,
I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. And like part of that is just like genre character, you know, genre, like showing that that's how you write in the genre is that you cite like according to that genre, you know? Yeah. And I try and tell my students that that's like always part of writing. It's always, you're always writing within constraint, you know,
interesting.
Some way, you know, some kind of constraints that are on you. And so I'm not saying this is like MLA is the right way to do it. In my class, MLA is the right way to do it. And if I give you an assignment sheet
and it
says to do this, you it's the same as you get any other assignment. Like it's the easiest thing for you to do is put 1-inch margins and use the font I tell you to. Easiest thing you're going to do. You know, and so
and yet people don't.
And yet, yes. And so I think like to go back to high school, I think if we really, I'm a rhetorician, y'all. So I think if we really pushed a rhetorical approach about writing in certain situations and that those certain situations have constraints and have, you know, things that need to be done. And so every situation was approached first by let's figure out the situation. That we would go a long way in communicating. And I think it's important because, you know, we're clearly a divided people on this planet. So we could use more understanding. And I think that's another way to continue to force students to write and not using AI.
Yeah. We've been talking for so long.
I'm really sorry. Yeah.
No, why are you sorry? I'm the one who's supposed to be in charge of this. But so I think we should wrap it up at least to like, so I can do my outro. And I'm just gonna.
No. Before you do anything, let me just, I have one final thing that I want to say.
Yes.
Phyllis sent me an outline for this show and it's got a numbered list. And number 4 says, we both ADHD. And then under that, it says, number 4, are there other things you want to talk about? And I've been looking at it the entire show and I love it so much. Because it's like so, it just is so illustrative of it itself. It's like the perfect marriage of form and content.
It's 4, we have ADHD, and then 4 again. It's so bad. Well, and I was going to say, like, I'm going to probably, this is going to be a heavily edited episode, I think. But if, like, you want more understanding of why coherence matters, if you were feeling frustrated by the many tangents that the two of us went, like, that is why coherence matters. All right. You are amazing. This is so, like, I kept thinking like, oh my God, I've got to stop it. But then I'm like, I want to hear more. And anyway, thank you so much. Like, especially all this writing stuff. It's all just like, again, it goes back to what we were starting with about portmanteaus. It's like these things that seem obvious that are just like, oh yeah, I can write or I can do this. Where it's like, it's when we start to deconstruct them or to tear them apart, or just to ask, like, why are we using this word? What is this? That, like, so much richness comes out of it. So thank you.
Thank you
so much. This has been so much fun. And thank you to our listeners. Thank you for all 8 of you. You're the best. Thank you for listening to Doing Social Research. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment. Please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform and share what you liked about it. And if you didn't enjoy this episode, no one wants to hear about that. So, but sharing about it will help, really help us to reach more listeners and make doing social research within the reach of everyone. I also would love to connect with you. You can follow me on Instagram or on X, Twitter. I'm not there as much, at SocioMama. You could join the Doing Social Research Facebook group. There are 4 of us in there right now. So keep the conversation going. Links to my social media references will be in the show notes. If you have a question about social research you'd like me to tackle on the podcast or questions that you have that you'd like a post maybe on the website, send me a message through social media or email me at phyllis.rippey@uottawa.ca. I would love to hear from you. Don't forget to check out the website, doingsocialresearch.com. It is still a work in progress, but it is a work of love. So special thanks to our sound editor, Willow Rippey-Young, for making us sound amazing. and wading through all of our tangents. Jonathan Boyle wrote our theme music, Like a Badass. That's the name of the song. I don't know him, so I don't know if he's a badass. That's my joke I keep making. I'm Phyllis Rippey, and this has been the Doing Social Research Podcast. And always remember, don't the bastards get you down, and keep doing social research. Bye!